said just before the three bullets, just under adoption of the agenda written by the department, something like Women's Month celebration. Mm. Just to give one or two remarks around that. And of course, if there are inputs from the members, we can have a short reflection around that. But let me welcome all of you to this committee meeting and indicate that we've got to be done at least by 20 past 12. I have a meeting, in fact we have a meeting as chairperson with the chair of all the committees, Honorable Frolic, in his office. So we've got to be done by that time. But let me welcome all the honourable members and welcome honourable Deputy Minister Lenders and the officials in the Department of International Relations, and also welcome honourable Darren Bergman. I want to pronounce it as an Afghan, not like as an English, not Batman.
English is the right.
Ah, that's very good, Batman. Welcome, Honorable Batman, to this meeting. I am told you are an alternate member of the Democratic Alliance. Most welcome. Good to have you here. Secretary, are there any approved apologies?
Thank you, Chair.
I have one apology. Honorable Daddy will join us a bit later. You are taken a bit. Thank you. Thank you very much. Any further apologies?
Where are the members? Where are the members? And the whip?
They are late. One is coming in. One, two, three, four, five. We are five. We do correct. Members are late. On the item that I've just inserted, I wanted us to note that that on Sunday we were celebrating the Women's Day, but the entire August is in fact the celebration of the Women's Month in terms of the calendar of the Republic of South Africa. And that yesterday there was a joint sitting of Parliament that also reflected on the achievements and the weaknesses that continue to be there, the achievements that have been made towards gender equality, and the weaknesses that continue to be within the entire South African society, where women are still lagging behind. But I think in his presentation on Sunday, the president indicated that we had a non-racial march to the Union Building. Now those who are young, the Union Building used to represent the title of apartheid system in those days. For the non-racial march in 1956, went there to demand that the hated apartheid passes, or don't pass, as they were called, be done away with. And of course, also what is important to note, I saw a presentation made by decided parliamentary forum about the representation of women as public representatives. It is as down as 21% in the whole world. Now, if you look at the speech of the president on Sunday, there are many other areas where he indicates that, you know, public representatives as in 1994, you had 2.7%. As of last year, it is 41%. We're talking about the NA. He also indicated what is happening in the magistracy, what is happening about the judiciary, what is happening in the universities, and many others. I just lifted one out of all of this for the purpose of our committee. It is that with regard to this department, Honorable Lenda, in 2001, there were only 8 women who were in the heads of nations as high commissioner, as ambassador, as of the year 2001. By last year, 2014, according to that presentation of the president, which is a report that comes from the Department of Women, we have moved to 29% from 17.42, which was 8, to 29%. Now, I think it is still very bad, and I think both ourselves as a portfolio committee and the department must join hands here. I don't think Telco is to blame. There is a need to recruit more women into the foreign service. And I think we don't have to concentrate, in my view, at looking at those who are high commissioners and ambassadors and consular generals. But the representation of women generally in all of the other levels, in the admin, in the many other fora that we are serving in, the European Union, the Spanish Parliamentary Forum, the incoming BRICS Parliamentary Forum, the Pan-African Parliament, and many other structures of the Foreign Service. We've got to have more and more women and more young women into those structures. And as we do so, it must also be done on a non-racial basis. Because one of the things that you would have noted that happened under apartheid, but apartheid is not the only one to blame. Patriarchy is also to blame about the fact that women are still behind in the world. Not just apartheid. So it means progressive men must join in the struggle or in the campaign for gender equality. So these are the things that we must attend to. Now, I think, David, because you are dealing with research, it could be good if you could get some notes for us about, you know, the representation of women in the many other international fora, like the United Nations, the AU, SADC, maybe all of the other regions within Africa, and we could have some discussion perhaps with the SA committee. But the issue of recruitment by us and by the department is a matter that I would want us to say one or two words, because it's an issue for all of us in South Africa. I want to add my input around this one, just there. If there are any comments, there are any views, I would like to invite them. I would like to have the facts. is it an administrative process, Honorable Khalafa?
No, it's political caucus.
Okay. Honorable Kalyan? Yes.
Thank you for your remarks, Chairperson. I just want to maybe seek clarity. You said that it's not Jerko is not to blame for the low numbers of women. But I just wanted to seek clarity. Is it not usually the prerogative of the president to make appointments or the leader of government business? To make such appointments. And then secondly, in your remarks, you referred to young women. So what about the old women and the more mature ones and the more competent ones and the experienced? I'm ready to take on a position, but when you say young, then of course it excludes me from...
You just
cornered
me.
That was the caucus all
about. Kenya.
Thanks, everything for the input. But I think, if you say that, may not keep women's issues. In fact, gender equality seriously, because we've got a clear policy. But you see that this policy is not implemented in some areas, and also in those areas which it is implemented, what you can see is that a lip service. You don't really see if really women are taken seriously, are taken care of. For example, I'll make just a small example. When you look at the when we have this women's month as women, men will start having men in Daba. And now my question is, why men in Daba? If they go, they still, if men say that at least now they are moving away from patriarchy. But the problem is that they have their own in Daba. Why don't they say gender in Daba? So that also women are included there. Maybe that women can be taken seriously if really they are part of that gender, of that in Daba. As a gender, not necessarily according to masculinity, masculinity, I can say. So, really, as women, we have been studying all the studies of women, and those women, and also that those women, which I'm also worried about, and those unsung heroes, when you talk about Mama Aida Mdwana, you seldom see her name, even Madiho Nkuma, those women who were the first president after Charlotte Mwakaike. But you don't hear about them, you only hear about Lillian Ngoyi. Now, I think also, as women, or as we must take all the women on board, and those men were very vocal, even in the Federation of South African Women of 1954, in that when the freedom, when the Women's Charter was drafted, they were there, and then they were present even before about Lillian Ngoyi, because when Charlotte Mwakaike died, my mom, Madiho Nkuma, was taken as a president, was elected as a president, the seventh president of the election, seventh president. So what I'm talking about, I'm sure that in the federation, they were all included that in the federation. So not necessarily on the political organization, they were included in the federation of South Africa, and they were part of those women that raised all the women of all races to come together to form Charter, and also moved forward to what you said to this, you know, to 1956 uprising. Thank you, Chairperson.
Yeah, thank you very much for your input, Honorable Kenny. Except that my caution to the member would be that we should not discuss Women's Month generally. If it was in Parliament, it would be all right. But in this specific instance, I was referring to the representation of women in the Foreign Service, because that's what falls within the purview of this portfolio committee, so that at least it is narrowed to that. And I lifted that out. I'm unable to answer for the men who convene an Indaba, you know. I suspect Honorable Olumisa is the one that can answer for them. Honorable Titi?
That's true.
Oh, yeah, okay. That's true.
I'm sorry, that's a slip of tongue. Because what I was coming to, I'm coming to the Federation of South African Women. And you said that all women were there.
Yeah.
So that's a slip of tongue. Right. That I separated them from other women.
Thank you very much. Madame Rapoti, welcome.
Watin Chava Praze. Watin Chiba Ota. So I was just saying that on what you have said, will it be proper, things that you have, you know, started the debate, but if we can get the report in that effect to check, you know, to have that kind of a report about the status of the women in, on the international relations, but not now, on the data stage, especially as we are going to the United Nations to go and give the report about issues of the Millennium Development Goals. So I think it will be proper if we can get the report so that we should be able to know in this committee how are we feeling in that regard. I thank you.
Any further observations? Honorable Lekosha.
Thank you, Chairperson. May I just apologize for coming slightly late. I was going to say that rather than dwell very much on history and on what we achieve as chance, can we talk to the issue, is there any budget in the department's work for recruitment, whether it's recruitment in institutions of learning or recruitment in civil society generally? Is there recruitment programs that are in existence that are annually, however modest they may be? Do we have programs that deal with this issue? And secondly, is there an indication, maybe on an annual basis or whatever identified period, that the department puts out to say there are these areas of particular expertise that require recruitment to focus on relating to recruitment of, well, generally you say this is the recruitment, we need people in these areas, and could we drive that in that recruitment a percentage of that recruitment must at least be women? So that whilst you are dealing with the general needs of a department, you are also identifying the areas of that you are targeting for transformational purposes. Yes, because otherwise, it means we are just depending on chance of who may apply or who may be curious about it. But as if we have a conscious program of that nature, we might be able to see this is what's our target at the beginning of the year, this is what we have been able to achieve. Or this was our target at the beginning of the term of government, and this is what we have achieved. And we can account for what we have budgeted for and what has come to us as a matter of level of awareness that we cultivate in society. I don't have answers to this question. I'm asking this question because I'd like to find out whether we are doing that. If we don't have programs of that nature, that we might want to recommend perhaps that given the size of the problem, et cetera, we then say, well, can we target, etc., etc. I think you said.
Yeah, meaning that when we report next year, 9 August, we say we've moved from 29% to something else. So I think you're quite correct. And I will end that. It just came. You may not have been ready for it, but
yeah, I wasn't ready, Chair, and I'm sitting here wondering why we weren't prepared for it. I'm not in a position to respond to the Honourable Lakota's question as to whether we have a recruitment program. Diplomacy is a specialized field. You don't go into a university and pluck someone who's completed a degree or master's degree and say, this is a diplomat. That would be a serious mistake, whether that person is male or female. Now, with that in mind, at some point back in time, Durko created an academy for the training of diplomats. Our academy, I make bold to say, is rated as, if not the best in the world, then certainly one of the best. It's headed by DDG Maud Jomo. At some point, Chairperson, I would urge you to invite her to come and speak to your committee. And alternatively, you can request an opportunity to visit the academy. The questions you've raised now, which are very important, can best be answered by the head of our human resources, DDG Mhai. And as in the case of Maud Loma, I would urge you to invite DDG Mhai to come and address you specifically on these issues, Chairperson. Whether the department has a recruitment program. If so, does it address the serious shortage of women in the foreign service? In the meantime, I will go back and ask them to prepare briefing notes on this matter. But look, I do know that my minister is critically aware of the shortcomings, and so, you know, if I were to go to her, I've no doubt that she would take about a good hour to explain to me all the steps she's taken and that the department has taken to try and address this problem. I do agree with you that 29% is hopelessly low and inadequate and has to improve.
Honorable Olamisa, thank you, Chairperson. Added to this debate, in order to get to the bottom of the whole issue, would be to answer the question how a diplomat is identified and appointed, because we've seen a lot of people who have failed in the administration, either as DGs or as cabinet ministers, but they end up being rewarded with diplomatic posts. So don't just confine this to only one area, but look in general at what kind of quality do we want to have in the to represent this country. Be it a woman, I don't question the percentage you are discussing, but at least you can't just be given a department and then you fail just because you belong to that such a family or party. Then you are rewarded with diplomatic post. It's embarrassing.
I think if one who have an in-depth discussion, the Deputy Minister just indicated that we could invite Ambassador Maud Jomo, who must be assisted by DDG
know how. That's what is discussion around it. I think appointment of people must be on a non-racial basis. Secondly, it must not be non-partisan. Any other good South African from any other party can represent South Africa. It has happened over many years, at least to the extent that I can remember from 1994. And thirdly, of course, we were talking about the possibility of increasing recruitment, and I take note of what you're saying, that you know, not everyone can be a diplomat just because the rector of that university or university of technology, or because they've got a master's or a doctorate. This is some kind of a specialized field. But of course, you have also said that we can visit the academy.
A request
to visit the academy. But I think it would first be better to invite them to come here. But Bongile, you and me, I think what we would do, once we've got some statistics, if before the end of August, we could just keep a very good article about the Foreign Service, the contributions and the weaknesses and all of those things. As chair, keeping. We think over the years, this is the contribution, the promotion, the appointment of women in the Foreign Service, and then also no Tamil witnesses. And especially the way forward, what do we think? In a way, in a manner that is informed by some facts, some statistics. But we can work on that. And can I be allowed to close the matter on that? And then defer to the Deputy Minister to start with any of the items, item 4 and 5. For a presentation, because that's what this meeting is specifically about today. Oh, that includes item number 6. Over to you, DM.
Chairperson, thank you, and thank you for the opportunity. Allow me to present representatives of DECO who are here this morning with me, and they will be leading the presentation. On my immediate right is Dr. Anil Suklau. Dr. Suklau is Deputy Director General responsible for Asia, Middle East, and BRICS. Next to Dr. Suklau is Mr. Sandile Skalk. Mr. Skalk is directly responsible for the African Union. You all know Zaire. He's in my office and sitting somewhat distant from Zaire. I don't know why. Is Laura Lazarus. Laura is responsible for media liaison, and there's, Serake Matsebe was here and then he suddenly disappeared. I don't know why, but you all know Serake, so he does not need any introduction. I'm going to ask Dr. Suklau to begin by briefing you on the outcomes of the 7th BRICS Summit. Russia, with your permission and permission of the committee chairs.
Honorable Chairperson, Honorable Deputy Minister London, Honorable Members, I have a PowerPoint presentation here which in essence summarizes the outcome of the 7th BRICS Summit hosted in Ufa in Russia. Our delegation was led by our President, and accompanied by several ministers. Just a presentation overview on the key outcomes, the summit outcome document, the summit outreach meeting, and the BRICS Track 2 and Track 3 engagements, as well as the processes we are involved in revising the BRICS strategy and the economic goals. As indicated, President Zuma led our delegation to the UPA summit, accompanied by our Minister of International Relations and Cooperation, Minister of Finance, Trade and Industry, State Security, Energy and Arts and Culture. theme for the summit was BRICS partnership, a powerful factor of global development, and the key summit outcomes attested to this partnership being indeed a growing and powerful factor in terms of addressing global development, especially as it affects the countries of the South and the African continent. The summit, of course, commenced with the traditional dinner on the evening of the 8th. On the 9th itself, was the day of the summit, but as now is an established tradition, which was initiated when South Africa hosted the BRICS summit in Itiquini in March 2013, we had an interaction between the BRICS Business Council. You will recall that this BRICS Business Council was the initiative of South Africa and it was launched during the Itiquini summit. And we had an interaction between the BBC leadership and the heads of government. And some of the issues that were discussed was in particular a request from our business community to expedite trade in local currencies, to facilitate business travel facilitation, and the recognition of the advisory role of the BBC. We have created the BBC as a very important and powerful instrument. You will recall that the first chair was the chair of the South African BBC, Patrice Motsepe. He has subsequently relinquished that position and it is now headed by Brian Molefe. The leaders discussed the agenda during the restricted and closed session. The BRICS summit is divided into two sessions. One is the restricted session, where more sensitive issues are addressed amongst the leadership, and the open session, where the public and media are also participants. And the theme of the session was global issues of politics and economics and the BRICS activities. BRICS leaders delivered statements based on the theme New Challenges and New Opportunities of BRICS Cooperation during the plenary and open session. The BRICS leaders welcomed the establishment of the BRICS financial institutions, namely the New Development Bank and the Contingent Reserve Arrangement, the CRA, that's the safety net that was created. The leaders announced that the respective domestic ratification process for the establishment of the NDB and CRA were concluded. You were part of the process of ratification of our agreement. And the first meeting of the NDP Board of Governors, the Board of Governors is made up of the finance ministers of all of the BRICS countries. So the first meeting took place on 7 July. This was a historic moment because it actually marked the operationalization of the bank. So the bank is now a living reality. It was a dream when we met in Itiquini. It was an idea of our president and former Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh that had discussions at a multilateral meeting to look at how we utilize our own funds in working for us. And this dream has now materialized into something very tangible. The British finance ministers concluded the process of appointing the new president of the bank, the vice presidents, and the board of directors. President Zuma congratulated the president of the bank, Mr. Kamat. Mr. Kamat was nominated by the Indian government. He's a very senior banker. He was head of one of India's largest private banks, the ICICI. And the four vice presidents, as per the agreement, because India provides the president, the other four countries will provide vice presidents. And South Africa has appointed Mr. Leslie Marsdorp to serve as the vice president in the NDB. And of course, we have the board of directors, non-executive directors were also appointed. And on the South African side, Mr. Tito Mboweni was the appointee recommended by the South African government. As you know, the headquarters of the bank is in Shanghai, and the board of directors consists of the ministers of finance of the BRICS member countries. The new development bank shall have an initial authorized capital of 100 billion, subscribed capital of 50 billion, equally shared among founding members. I think this is what is different about the bank, that you have countries of different scales in terms of economic size, in terms of weightage, but South Africa thought that this bank has to be based on an equal shareholding. So all of the member states, doesn't matter that our GDP may be a small compared to the GDP of China, which is in the region of $10 trillion at the present time, but we have equal shareholding and equal say in this bank. South Africa has to contribute an amount of $2 billion within a seven-year period. So this is a phased contribution. The voting power of each member shall be equal and subscribe shares in the capital stock of the bank. The initial size of the CRA, now the CRA, as you know, is a safety net when countries experience fiscal difficulties and in need of outside assistance. The BRICS decided to create their own safety net, which is called the Contingent Reserve Arrangement, and this is also activated. It has an amount of $100 billion. China will provide $41 billion, Russia, India and Brazil, $18 billion each, and South Africa, $5 billion. Now this money is not paid in. It's money that countries hold. Should any one of us fall into severe financial crisis, we don't have to go to the World Bank and beg them for a loan. We can draw from this BRIC pool. Then that funds will become activated dependent on the scale of a loan that is required by one of the BRICS member states. So it's a safety net for us. It's a unique facility that takes us outside the grip of the World Bank stranglehold. The customary pre-summit meetings that were held included that of the BRICS Ministers of Finance. This is traditional. Ministers of Finance must meet in the capacity as the NDB Board of Governors. They are as I said, comprise the Board of Governors. Then the BRICS Ministers of Trade has to meet. Trade is a standing issue in BRICS. It's one of the major pillars of BRICS in the economic dimension. So finance and trade ministers are customary meetings that must be held immediately before the summit. And of course, of late, the national security advisors also meet prior to the summit, given the global security situation. And because we have been negotiating for a number of years an intergovernmental agreement on culture, our ministers of culture also met. As you know, following the summit, on the 21st of July, the NDB in Shanghai was officially launched by the Minister of Finance of China, Mr. Lo Jiwei. And also present was Mayor of Shanghai, the President of the Bank, Mr. Mastov, our Vice President, Mr. Bueni was present, as well as our CG, Mr. Chavez from Shanghai. The Shanghai Institute for International Studies also hosted an international seminar on the BRICS New Development Bank under the theme From Ideas to Reality, which basically takes us from the journey that I explained earlier on, an idea between presidents that has gelled into a very tangible outcome. The BRICS leaders announced that their respective domestic ratification process with the establishment of the bank and the CRA were concluded. The first meeting of the bank Board of Governors took place, as I alluded to. The finance ministers concluded the process of appointing the new president. They had to formally, as governors of the bank, endorse the appointment of Mr. Kamat, and they also had to endorse the vice presidents and board of directors. The non-executive directors were also appointed, which include Mr. Mbueni, as I said. Russia is the chair of the board of governors, and Brazil is the chair of the board of directors. It was all of these high-level positions were panned out. Because China got the seat of the headquarters, China didn't get a position on any of these. And because we got the African Regional Center, we didn't. Therefore, we had to give Russia something. Russia was given chair of the board, and we had to give Brazil something. Brazil was given chair of the board of directors. So everyone was happy with this the way we resolve the sharing of portfolios. Mm-hmm. With regard to the outcomes in terms of agreements and MOUs that were signed, as I indicated, there was an agreement on cooperation in the field of culture. Our Minister of Culture, Mr. Nachin Kwete, was there to sign this on our behalf. Then we also had an MOU on the creation of a joint BRICS website. This is a virtual website that will be open to not only BRICS members but to the public, so that it becomes a very important tool for BRICS members to put online what we are doing, but more importantly, for global community to also know what is going on within the BRICS family. As we have said, the BRICS is a very transparent creation, and it is there for trying to the developing world and the world of the South, including the African priorities, and we do this in a very open, transparent manner. The other important MOU that was signed was that between cooperation between the NDB and our development bank. DBSA signed on our behalf and with BRICS countries also concluded the framework program for funding joint research on science, technology, and on innovation. Now, of course, it's customary that you also have a UFA declaration, a political declaration, and an UFA action plan. This was negotiated through the Sherpa track over a period of 6 days and many, many mornings. And in the end, we had what we thought a very balanced declaration consisting of 77 paragraphs, and of course, as you can see, it deals with all of the global issues of concern to ourselves, the BRIC community, and the international community. Global politics, some of the issues that we reflected on was the 70th anniversary of the founding of the UN, the world finance, economy, and trade. We also commented on what is going on and some of the challenges we face in that area. And we also addressed new challenges and threats. For example, the issue of the global drug problem, corruption, combating transnational organized crime, piracy, armed robbery at sea, outer space, youth and exploration for peaceful purposes, the positive role for ICTs, and the importance of security in the use of ICTs. These were some of the areas that were new, but also discussed at length and to see what role BRICS can play in addressing these global challenges. On regional issues, we reflected on the Middle East situation, in particular Syria, Iraq, the challenges posed by ISIS, the crisis, ongoing crisis in Iran, which at that stage of P5+1 negotiations were still ongoing. Now, fortunately, that has been resolved. The situation in Afghanistan, the Ukrainian crisis, and of course on the African continent, we focused on the hotspots in Africa, Libya, South Sudan, Somalia, Mali, DRC, Burundi, Khan, and of course the challenge of Boko Haram in terms of security in the region. Sectoral cooperation in the economic sphere. The BRICS states are convinced about the importance of economic growth based on balanced development of all economic sectors and on the development and introduction of advanced technologies and innovation. The mobilization of resources from financial institutions and the encouragement of private investment. Cooperation in the social and humanitarian sphere was also deliberated on, and the declaration notes the direct interdependence between investment into education, the development of human capital, and the improvement of economic performance. And it reaffirmed the need for equally accessible, high quality, and lifelong education for all, in line with the post-2015 development agenda. Sustainable development issues were also discussed, as was cooperation with the parliament, business, and civil society. I will delve a bit into that. It was further included various new areas of cooperation that have been embarked on by the Russian chairship. I must say, Russia took its chairship and is taking its chairship in a very serious light. It has arranged a range of high-level meetings and has put a lot of energy, not only in the organization of the summit, and you could see President Putin was very hands-on in the way the summit was conducted, and the commitment of Russia to the BRICS family was very, very visible. And the energy, something like 80 meetings are being held during Russia's chairship, and that gives you an idea of the commitment to further deepen the cooperation within BRICS. The UFA Action Plan reflects the following events and initiatives. These are meetings already held, and you can see from the listing there are a high number of meetings that have already taken place prior to the summit. Forthcoming events, we have 26 forthcoming events, including all of those ministerials that are reflected there under. It will again give you an idea of the deepening level of cooperation on the sectoral front and other initiatives. Head of Migration Authorities, and also BRICS Dialogue on Peacekeeping, establishment of the BRICS Council of Regions and Cooperation, and exchange of experience among BRICS media professionals. other important developments in terms of a document that was endorsed by the summit was the strategy for BRICS economic partnership. Now, at the summit in Porto Alegre last year, the BRICS leaders asked the Sherpas to look at how BRICS countries can deepen the economic cooperation and to develop a medium to long-term strategy on how this can be done. So over the past year, under the Sherpa track, we've had a number of meetings, starting in Brazil, and also subsequently with Russia taking over the chairship at the end of March. A number of meetings were held in Russia, which brought us to the point where we had an agreed document that was endorsed by the Sherpas and by the ministers and presented to the leaders for endorsement, and it was adopted. This is a very good strategy document that looks at nearly all of the sectors of economic cooperation and what needs to be done to deepen this cooperation. The challenge now is to actualize the strategy so that it becomes operational. So that is what has been now tasked to the Sherpas and the ministers to oversee the development of a roadmap between 2015 and 2020, where we take the so-called low-hanging fruits, projects that are doable in terms of cooperation amongst ourselves on the economic front, and that we develop this roadmap before the end of December. That was the timeline given to us to have this action plan ready. Of course, as was the tradition which we set in motion in South Africa when we hosted the fifth summit, where we had the first outreach program that BRICS ever had with the African leadership. You will recall that we had the outreach of the leaders of Africa, some 15 African leaders converged in Chukwene and had an interaction with the BRICS leadership. And Brazil continued their tradition last year, where they had a meeting between the leaders of the BRICS countries and the leaders of the Latin American states, the 11 heads of state, all attended. Likewise, Russia continued this tradition by having an outreach with the Shanghai Cooperation Organization members, which is a security architecture comprising of Central Asian states, China and Russia, as well as the Eurasian Economic Union. In total, 11 leaders, with all of them at the level of heads of state attended, and the theme for that dialogue was to ways to increase the well-being of the people of our country. And all of them again spoke of the value of BRICS in terms of bringing focus to issues of concern to the developing world into the global mainstream, and showed total support for what BRICS was doing and a willingness and an eagerness to want to work and cooperate with BRICS. President Putin summarized the outcome of the BRICS and SCO summits by remarking that they represent a big step in developing our country's multifaceted cooperation. It is this diversity and coming together of different traditions that gives the BRICS group and the SCO the strength and tremendous potential. Now, with regard to BRICS Track 2 and Track 3 engagements, Russia hosted the first BRICS parliamentary forum. We had a chair of the NCOP leading our delegation to that meeting, and I'm sure she shared with you the outcome of that very important meeting, and it's now been accepted as part of the BRICS architecture, and this will be an annual event that will be henceforth hosted in the BRICS Parliamentary Forum. I think it's a very important addition to the BRICS architecture of our meeting. During the meeting, the participants discussed in the area the significant role of parliaments of BRICS in resolving critical issues of international concern and making BRICS an international mechanism for consultation and cooperation on key issues of global politics and the economy. The key outcome was the statement of the first BRICS First Parliamentary Forum, which was adopted on the 8th of July. The forum agreed to create mechanism for cooperation between legislative bodies and exchange experiences in order to further improve the national legislative system. Now, historically also, the first meeting of the BRICS, Civil BRICS Forum was held. Now, you'll recall in 2013, South Africa put out the idea, given the strong pressure we were facing from our own domestic civil society structures, that BRICS cannot just be a meeting, an intergovernmental meeting. It has to carry the people with them. And despite the fact that we had created a Track 2, the Academic and Think Tank Forum, have been doing a lot of work. One of the, I think South Africa is the only country from the BRICS family that has a regular interaction. I convene a meeting twice a year with civil society, once before a summit to hear what issues of concern that they would like us to raise in the meeting. And secondly, we have a report back following the summit. We have been doing this since 2013, religiously, and we have about 12 or 13 civil society structures that are very keen on what is happening. It's open to anyone, but on average we get about 12 or so organizations attending. We help them to craft a position paper on the need for a civil society track within BRICS, which they then sounded out with the fellow BRICS member countries, and it has now found currency. And one of the countries that was not so supportive of a civil society track was the first country to host the civil society forum. And we had a number of South Africans, about 35 of them, that participated. Tomorrow there's a report back meeting of those that participated in this forum being hosted by the HSRSP. Now, of course, when Russia informed us that they're going to have a civil society forum, they came to interact with us. We immediately endorsed it and said it's a very good initiative. They wanted us as government then to give them names of organizations, and we refrained from doing that, because we said as government we should be neutral to this process. And we suggested rather, given that they have a very vibrant embassy in Pretoria that's very active, that an ambassador that's been here for 3 years that has a sound interaction with civil society, we suggested rather the embassy interact with civil society. So in the end, what changed is the Russians, at least in the South African situation, they went to the BRICS think tank council, the interim think tank council, which is up to end of April was housed in the HSRC. They asked them to coordinate participation from civil society. So that is the mechanism they used, and eventually about 35 South Africans went, and we didn't have any complaints from the non-governmental sector about some being excluded from this process, as was the case last year when Brazil appointed Oxfam Brazil to organize a civil society forum. This time the Russian government was behind it, and it seems generally South African civil society was very pleased. And in my interaction with some of those that attended, they found that it was a very useful forum, and they are happy now that we have this track ingrained in BRICS. Of course, the trade union forum, again South Africa was a pioneer here. COSATU arranged the first trade union forum on the eve of the Itekwini summit in 2013. And as a result of that meeting of the trade union forum in South Africa, Brazil continued their practice, and of course in Russia this year, the trade unions have also met to deliberate on issues of concern. For the first time, we had the BRICS Youth Summit, also at the Itekwini summit. We put this as a new area of cooperation, that we should create a forum for youth to interact. And the first such summit took place in Moscow, in Kazan, from the 4th to 7th. And the heads of agencies responsible for youth affairs signed an MOU on cooperation on youth affairs, which will ensure ongoing collaboration. Now, when South Africa became a member of BRICS, and in 2011, as we were starting to prepare for hosting the summit in 2013, Cabinet indicated that we need to have a strategy on how to engage with BRICS. What is it? We are part of the BRICS family, but what do we want to achieve in terms of our own national interest, in terms of advancing our continental interest, and in terms of advancing our global interest? So Cabinet just then tasked NERCO and National Treasury to come up with a strategy. So during the course of 2012, we collaborated widely with all government departments, which resulted in a strategy document that consisted of two parts, one dealing with the political dimension, which was coordinated by NERCO, and the other dealing with the economic and finance dimension, which was coordinated by National Treasury. And in the end, NERCO collapsed both into one document that went to Cabinet and was endorsed. And adopted in preparation for us hosting the summit in 2013. But when we, in that document, we did say that this is a living document, that the global environment changes constantly, and BRICS is an emerging body, it is evolving, and there will be new dynamics. When we crafted our strategy, there was no such thing as a BRICS bank or a CRA in place. That was something. Obviously now, various other ministerial tracks have come on board, the civil society track, parliamentary forum, trade union forum are all on track. Now this time what we agreed, that we need to revise the strategy, and we have embarked on that process. But unlike the first strategy that was only consulted between government entities, this strategy is also being consulted with civil society. We held 3 workshops thus far to consult the strategy. And during the course of this remaining months of this year, we will consult all stakeholders in government in terms of revisiting this strategy and revising it and strengthening it, and hopefully by the middle of next year this process should be over. So that's where we are in terms of revising our strategy. And this will bring us in time, because we will again host the BRICS Summit in 2018. That may seem far away, but it's not too far away. And we need to prepare for that. But also 2018 will mark an important milestone. It will mark the 10th anniversary of the founding of BRICS when we host in 2018. BRICS economic overview, I think you are very familiar with the BRICS contribution. I mean, there has been a lot of there's been a lot written about the sluggish performance of some BRICS countries, including China. China's slow growth. And one of the things I always say, that when a country of a GDP of $10 trillion is growing at 7%, and you call that slow growth, you must understand it's 7% of a $10 trillion economy. And when EU on average is growing around 1% of a $18 trillion economy, the EU combined 28 members, the total GDP is 18 million. They're growing at 1%. But a $10 billion of one country growing at 7%, you say that's a crisis. So it must be seen within the context that BRICS is not a welcome addition to the global community, because it is shaking the established structures of power. And obviously you're going to find a lot of anti-BRICS writing, and this is prevalent throughout. We know Brazil is undergoing difficulties. We know Russia with unilateral sanctions is undergoing difficulties. But if you look at any writing on the world in 2030 or world in 2050, and there's a whole number of studies from major think tanks, Shell Review, MasterCard Review, Ernst & Young, Goldman Sachs, Russia, Brazil, India, and China will be in the top 6 of the global economy. In the top 6. South Africa will be around 24, 25, but in the top 30. Given the size of South Africa, that is still highly impressive. So we may be going through some difficulties, but you cannot write that off. But you can see increasingly total bilateral trade between South Africa and BRICS has increased dramatically from 203 billion. 382 billion. We expect it to reach about 500 billion within the next year. It's growing substantially. Just to give you an idea of the world in 2050 that I was speaking of course China will be by far the largest global economy. That is predicted to happen before 2030 actually. Prediction is anytime between 2022 and 2026 that will happen. And India will become the third largest economy before 2030. That's expected around 2026 or so. Brazil, as you can see, even in 2050, Brazil is projected to be the fourth largest global economy, and Russia is the fourth. So you have in the BRICS a powerful configuration of countries, not just based on economic size, not just based on economic size, but the values that BRICS espouses and seeks to address in creating a more balanced global order. Not only on the political front, but on the economic and financial sector. Chair, I think I will stop here. This is just a brief one.
Thank you very much, DDG Suplak, for a very informative, detailed, and a very good presentation on the outcomes of the BRICS summit at UFA in Russia. I'm going to invite comments and clarifying questions from the honorable members, and I would imagine that you will be assisted by both the GM and yourself and other officials to respond to comments and or any questions. Now, on the 16th of July, the minister was launching the Association of Former Ambassadors and the High Commissioner Chief Representatives, and after she had launched that structure, she then came to the second floor to launch another one. Called SACWAI, South African Council of on International Relations, and they then elected Aziz Ahad, former deputy minister. Now he said, you know, minister, you met the former ambassador, now you are meeting the real think tank. Now this big think tank reminds me of what he was saying that day. Yeah, can I hear members? Honorable Mukalapa? Let me just note. Honorable Mukalapa and Kalia?
Thank you.
I'm going to note you. Thank you very much, Chair. Let me also thank the DDG for the feedback and report. I think it is quite very much eloquently done, and it gives us a broad spectrum of what was happening, and definitely the technocrats were hard at work. Just to highlight four issues. The first one is that would I be correct in making an assumption that the BRICS remains more of a trade bloc rather than of a political bloc or any other consideration? Why do I say that? If you look at the summit declaration on global politics, which speaks about the reform of the Security Council, why does it come short into having direct support for the aspirations of the member countries who aspire for the Security Council, and in particular South Africa? Because of, if it's a political bloc and then we're moving together with one voice and we come to a consensus that we must reform the Security Council, why do we stop short at supporting our own? So I would want clarity on that one. The second one is on the issue of civil society. Myself and the chairperson and Honorable Radeve and Honorable Lepota, we attended a civic society workshop organized by the University of Johannesburg. And we had civil society that went to the BRICS, as well as trade unions that went to the BRICS. And what they said to us there was the issue of trust deficit between government and civil society in coming up with a common approach to the issues in BRICS. In fact, the trade union said to us when they went to Fortaleza in Brazil, they went on the invite of the Brazilians, and the South African government didn't want anything to do with it. So how do we coordinate the issue of civil society rather than demonizing them?
because of civil society was saying we were there and we were just left to dry on ourselves. And I think it's just been confirmed by yourself when you said you didn't want to get involved. You just said to them, to the Russians, you sort it out. And I think we got to improve on that one, because if we move with them with one voice, it makes it better for us in terms of bargaining our national interests when we are at this forum. And then the third one is the issue of Russia and the nukes deal. I know that it might be something that is way out, but there is this perception that the UFA declaration or the UFA BRICS meeting might have paved the way in terms of the nukes deal, that we are still don't know what the details are. Can you make a comment on it? And the parting shot is this one. Apart from being a trade bloc, why does it seem as if human rights have been relegated in this forum? Is it my correct assertion to make that it appears that the human rights has been relegated? All the stuff has been included here, economic partnership, youth, all those kind of things, but nothing that is referenced when it comes to human rights. Doesn't it that compromise ourselves in terms of our foreign policy principles and in terms of our constitutional imperative? Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Mkhalapa. Honorable Kalyan.
Thank you, Chairperson. This was indeed a very enlightening presentation, and one of the last points that were made around the anti-BRICS dialogue, I think this presentation has helped a lot to clarify that. But I'd also want to know, what are we doing to counter that? Because the World Bank obviously is being threatened, and does it have an impact on IMF and things like that? With regard to China, the headquarters in China China undergoing so many problems at the moment, and the fact that China has now cut its flights to South Africa, there seems to be a trade reduction. Would that, do you think, have an impact on the agreements that have been reached in terms of BRICS? And then with regard to the term of office of the presidency, is it a fixed term? Is there like a rotation? And how does the rotation work? Is it in alphabetical order, or you pull it out of the hat, or whatever? My colleague has touched on the UN situation, but I'd like a clear answer, a yes or a no. Does South Africa support a comprehensive reform of the UN, yes or no? Because this declaration has remarked on it, but we haven't supported it. Now, how can you be part of the declaration but not support something that's in the declaration? And then in conclusion, it would be great to get that declaration. I know that it's long and it's divided into several parts, but by actually reading it for ourselves, I think it would be nice. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Kalyan. What the theme is for Honorable Kalyan?
Thanks, Chairperson. And thanks, Doctor, for that enlightening presentation. Chairperson, I would like to say that the presentation indicates that the progress made so far is very impressive. And the likelihood is that going forward, we are still to see more. But I wanted to check if it is possible. Is it possible that we can be able to compare the BRICS Bank with the World Bank? And just to show how they are operating and whether we are indeed in the right track by being part of this bank. And the other issue, Chair, in South Africa we have always championed the right of women. I wanted to check if it's possible that we can maybe come up with a BRICS summit or forum on women. Sure. Thank you.
Honorable Kenya.
Thank you, Sebastian. Thank you for the presentation. Also, I'm sharing the same sentiment of commending this report, that this presentation, as my colleagues have done so. My question, I think Honorable Kelly has asked part of the president, but mine, I also included the term of the non-executive director, which I understand each country has got its own in the five countries. So just to know the term of office also for the non-executive director. Secondly, on page 61, I'm worried about this voting power of each member that says that talks to that it shall be equal to the presentation, its subscription. Now, when you look at this page, I'm worried by South Africa, because to my understanding, South Africa, maybe it's I'm for the national interest also. When you look at this bullet, now, that comes after that bullet that talks to the voting power, the second paragraph that talks to, when I look the breakdown, that China will provide 41 in the 100 billion CRA. Now, when you look at South Africa, South Africa has got 5, and others, the 3 others, South Africa, Brazil, and India, have got 18 billion each, and ours also is always down there. Now, my question, that is why I'm asking this question, what will happen to South Africa if the voting power depends on the subscriptions? Noting that South Africa has got this 5 billion in the, I'm talking about the capital stock of the bank. Now that in CRA we've got this 5 billion alone, and also on the capital stock we've got that 7, that 2 billion in 7 years. So my question now is relating to the power for national interest rate. What will be happen really to South Africa on when it comes to voting power? On page 14, talking about the post 2015 development agenda, and also in the sustainable development, I'm always worried about this because we don't know how far we've gone with the MDGs. We are always talking about the post development agenda of 2015, but we don't know what has happened to the Millennium Development Goals. When you look at the sustainable, because to my understanding, if we're talking about sustainable development goals, we must first know and evaluate the Millennium Development Goals, how far we've gone in these 15 years on reduction. Because really, how are we going to work if we don't have the SWOT analysis from the entities if we want to get sustainable development goals? And then lastly, when we talk about page 4 and page 17, there's this establishment of BRICS. I don't understand now because the business has, on page 4, we're talking about the establishment of business BRICS council. Now, I don't, now just want to make, maybe I'm making a mistake when I say now I'm not in page 17, I'm talking about the establishment of the council. Is this the same council that talks to business? Or another country that is on page 17, versus page 4. Thank you, Sebastian.
Thank you, Honorable Kenya, Honorable Khatele, followed by Olome.
Thank you, Chairperson. First of all, I think this presentation has shown a lot of light on the operations of the BRICS. And then what you see is really good. It's really good. But the question is, I'd like to ask you,
although there's this anti-BRICS sentiment, this anti-BRICS sentiment, but when you look at the new development bank, and then compare it in particular with the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, what's the difference between the two? Because I can see that although America was against the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, its colleagues, Germany, Britain, they went rushing into investing into this bank, although it was initiated by China. What's the difference between the two? And then why? Because when you look at that AIIB, you find that the investment and subscription has been open to all the other countries who are interested in that. The new development bank, it looks like it has been restricted. What was the rationale behind that? Because I think that if we had more contingency reserves, we could do more as we're moving forward. Number two, Chair, I'll go to the issue of the appointment of the Vice President. I see that it was the Minister of Finance who made the appointment, but I was more interested in the process, because definitely I would have liked Lubabalu to be that Vice President for South Africa. How did they arrive to, how was the process? Was it a public nomination process, or was it a closed nomination process, something of that nature, and the rationale behind each name? And then, Chairperson, what is also critical here is the issue of, that's the third part, the issue of the strategy for BRICS economic partnership. I think it's very good that it emphasizes the issue of the beneficiated goods. I think it tallies actually well, and it tallies well with our industrial policy action plan, that what we want to sell outside is something which is beneficiated, not the raw land, not the raw materials. And then, but what I'm interested in between these countries, and I look at South Africa and Russia in particular, what beneficiated goods are mainly in the basket for that? Because if you say that, they emphasize that, what does it, just give example of the beneficiated goods which are being sold in between the countries. And then, the last one, really, it was revolutionary that they involved the civil society, trade union forum, the Greek Business Council. I think that is our way of life in South Africa, that we broaden the participation so that we help divide it. But I think that what is very emphatic out of this thing, it does not mean that when we belong to the Greek countries, we are anti-West. No, I think that one must be on record. We are not anti-West. We are not anti-World Bank or anti-IMF. The issue is that we are putting a basket of choices for our country so that at the end of the day we are able to do. In particular, the issue of the contingency reserve land. contingency reserve fund is so critical. If you can look at other countries now, like your Greece, the processes, the pain which they have to go through. But what is actually making more heavy about this one is that this money is not kept somewhere. It is in the country. The only thing that it must be available on call. I think that one is very revolutionary. It's very revolutionary, so that because we don't know, it might be the first one to need that good. So it means that if China has got $41 billion US dollars ready for us, I think that that's a good question. I think that this is a real good story to tell. We have to go and tell the people out there that this thing is the way to go. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Akbare Olomisa, and most welcome, Honorable Mwango, you of the people's high. One of the favela Uti, Mina Nawe, one of.
Yeah.
I see. The higher you go, the colder you come.
Exactly. That's why you are contributing $41 billion as Chinese.
The person in honor of Mungu, don't tell my head time. We support this process. And it is not going to be perfect only on a single day. It's going to be It's going to take some time, but I would like us to question, especially the International Relations Department. You are aware that we are very good in ratifying international treaties, and we contribute a lot of money in some of them. But we are shy to claim those monies for the development of our people. You can take, for instance, issues like biodiversity, lots of international conventions which we are contributing. Is it possible, or will you be able to brief this portfolio committee in future as to what will be the priorities of South Africa? What kind of projects will we be asking this bank to assist us on? I'm thinking here about the infrastructure of the townships, the rural areas, former homelands, where if you drive around South Africa, you can still see big scars. When are we going to, why can't we focus on those areas rather than borrowing money from this bank and invest them in elite projects, which we are not sure whether they will generate revenue or funds in the future. Elite projects which might end up being implemented by some of these partners in the BRICS countries, as opposed to putting the interests of South African expertise to benefit from. I would hate that this, as part of this continent, we are once more going to be used. This time around, we need to make sure that we work for the ordinary people on the ground. They must feel this. Just to make one example, take for instance the Global Fund, which is more related on funding the environmental related projects. There are very few companies or institutions in this country which claim that money. But it ended up in Kirstenbosch areas. You don't see it in the township. You don't see it in the rural areas. Please, man. It's sickening. We have been signing, paying, but we are not benefits. There are no benefits for our people. That's simplifying this thing. Don't rush and say, all right, we'll sign this bank, this account. It must go to a certain elite process. Now we must now put e-toll road somewhere. But I hope you have heard that. Just come back and tell us in future what would be the priorities. I guess then you will have to sit down with the Presidential Infrastructure Committee. But if they are bringing up some of the elite projects again, the voters who are voting for us and to be here will continue to suffer for years.
Thank you, Honorable Olomisa. This is the last one, Honorable Raphuthi. Bring it closer to you.
Yes. Thank you for the excellent presentation. And we really appreciate the fact that South Africa is part of the family. And even in the team of the Development Bank, you know, that faith is from ideas to reality. And I think it's real. We can see that really something is really happening. And I think that really the South African community is really going to benefit from this development bank and even from the Greek family. And I also like what, you know, on all the agreements that are there, they also even highlight the issue of the
the issue of the United Nations Security Council, and you can see that they have outlined even how even some other ministers are going to even inter, you know, have some dialogues or even some communication on lots of issues on health, on employment, and all those things. I think really it's a real issue that is happening, and we really want to thank you for that presentation.
Thank you, Honorable Kenyan. I will also. Oh, sorry, Honorable Rafuji. Sorry.
Well, my apologies, Chairman, for arriving late. I started with the police portfolio Wednesday. They are very difficult for me. Well, on page 6, the first paragraph, first bullet, something is said about the authorized capital of $100 billion. And that the subscribed capital shall be $50 billion, equally shared among founding members. And South Africa will be paying $2 billion of that. Is it possible to break down exactly how much each member will be paying? And why is South Africa paying $2 billion? If this is actually, it also hinges on the voting power of each member.
Am I also allowed to make one or two comments? You are overloaded now.
No, you can.
Yes. If you had looked at the history of the IMF and the World Bank over the last 7 years, and you take leave of some of the observations that the director of the Center for Conflict Resolution has said in the book called The Curse of Berlin. He is ably assisted by some other writers. They try to trace what that conference of 1885 did to Africa, and how the decisions that were taken there, looking at them at the developing of the, at the development of Africa, how bad, how it has been a curse to the African continent since that time. And now the rest, as they say, is history. But just to be fair to the IMF and the World Bank, the structural adjustment programs, which then undermine the political economies of the nation states, because if you borrow from them, they then say, you're not going to do this, you're not going to do this. So you as public representatives must then jettison that which you think assists your people from an economic point of view. It would, for instance, it would come in and say, your national development plan, put it aside. You must do the policy. Because they will impose very strict strictures and conditionalities. But I'm not going to get into that. You know why I foreground my comment with that? It's because I want to say that my sense is that the date and the year in which the BRICS was launched should mark the tilting of the economic balance of forces, economic stroke trade balance of forces in the world, which must reverse that which the curse of Berlin imposed on the developing countries. So it's, I hope historians will make that assessment and appropriate issues very scientifically and see how the world, how the development of the world has been going on or will be going on forward. My sense is that at least the BRICS grouping will make an intervention in the development of the other countries. And with that, I want to ask the following question. The non-member states of BRICS, are they going to benefit? Some of us have sympathies with countries like Cuba for historical reasons, countries like Palestine, but in the home ground meaning the continent, does it mean that our neighbors, our Zimbabwe, our Swaziland, our Botswana, our Niger, our Cote d'Ivoire, DRC, etc., who may not be sitting in BRICS, and who have the same challenges of infrastructure and development as ourselves, will they be also benefit? What are the conditions? And the other one is deployment. You know, Honorable Holomisa just came close to something I would have wanted to say, that we ratify a lot of agreements, etc., etc. But in this case, the people that we deploy to ensure that they become the eye and the ear of the South African government and its people. If I could recommend, for instance, you need people who must understand the Brazilian language, the Russian language, and Mandarin, to the extent that, because the one on the forum is very influential in many areas, economic, think tanks, civil society, trade union, all of these things. So you may need people who must guide you, who must hear what is happening. Remember, although as BRICS we may have issues about the West, and we have, and correctly so, but we are going to have our own intra-BRICS competition about who gets what. It's only natural for all nation states, where within this they will pursue national interest. So, the last one is whether there will be any exchange of skills among all the five countries. Obviously, you will not have same levels of skills for development, whether they would also look at that. I don't know which forum will look at that, but to ensure that, you know, if you've got sufficient of this skill in India, for instance, it can be moved to Russia to deal with the construction of steel bridges, roads, etc., etc., or they can come to South Africa, or they can go to any other country. In the area where I grew up, there are two bridges. They are called Hama Bridge or Matalia. I come from Pumalanga. That road from Carolina to Machalada, that's the farm where I grew up. There is a very nice bridge that has been constructed there. But the pattern is the same as the one that you see when you drive from Carolina to Bonafonte. Those bridges were built by the Italians. But if you go to Matulu and Nelspruit, there's a bridge of the train. You look at the architecture, Yamataria. So it means South Africa was importing that skill. So I'm just saying the exchange of skills within countries that have the same interest will be important, but we're just asking a question. I'm sorry, I've been too long. Over to you, DM and your officials.
Thank you. Thank you, Honorable Chairs, Honorable Members. I think there are a number of very pertinent questions pertaining to the presentation. Maybe I will just take them in the order that they were asked. You see, when BRICS was launched initially, where South Africa was not a member, the first summit in Yekaterinburg. It was a coming together in a loose form of the four countries. And the focus, if you look at the first summit, was totally economic. Totally economic. But when they started realizing that the four countries have a lot in common in terms of the challenges they'd like to address on the global stage, BRICS then began institutionalizing itself. The second summit took place in Brazil. And then they recognized that the need for such a bloc, but that something was missing in creating a new global power bloc, and that's what BRICS became, a new global power bloc. In 1975, when the G7 got together, it was actually six countries in 75, to launch the G7. Russia became a member, and it became G8 in 1993, much later. They created a global power bloc, and between 75 to almost the present time, the global agenda was not set in the UN, which is the global body. It was set at the annual meetings of the G7. That is where they discussed global politics, global economics, global finance, without us, without our participation and setting policy. So the question, last year when I was in Berlin for a conference on BRICS, there was a high level of focus on BRICS by the Europeans and Americans. The question one of the participants raised, why do you have a need to create a BRICS? Are you not undermining multilateralism and the UN system? I said, if you can give me a valid answer why you fractured the globe in 1975 and created the G7, why did you find the need in 1975 to create a G7 and then to determine what is in our best interest? Then I will tell you why we had to create the BRICS. And BRICS was created precisely to underpin multilateralism. And we say this constantly. Every declaration of the BRICS speaks to the centrality of the United Nations and the multilateral system. Be it the UN, be it the Bretton Woods architecture that needs reforming, be it the WTO that needs reforming. But as you see, every summit declaration, it moves beyond just an economic body. Because economics doesn't function in a vacuum. Today, everyone's going to rush to Iran and to Cuba only because there's a political agreement. Without a political agreement, you cannot go and do business in Iran. Without a political agreement between Cuba and USA, USA business people cannot go to Cuba. So we live in a world where geopolitics and geoeconomics are intertwined with each other. So BRICS cannot exist just to address global economic issues. Therefore, the documents that come out of BRICS declaration is very elaborate on the global political dimension. What is happening with Boko Haram in the north of Africa impacts on the whole of Africa. What is happening in the Middle East on ISIS impacts on us. So this, therefore, BRICS is not just about economics. Economics and finance is one of the central pillars of BRICS, and therefore the major part of your declaration focuses on it. But you cannot ignore the global political dynamic and the regional dynamic that impacts on all of this. So it's an integrated BRICS that we speak of. On reform, you see it's a 77 paragraph declaration. Our view of South Africa that it was too elaborate and that BRICS should become a bit more selective as we mature and grow. It's almost impossible to comment on every given global situation in detail. Be it human rights, which is critical, it was discussed. It doesn't mean if it's not captured in the declaration. We were given 4 days to discuss the declaration at the level of Sherpa and Sherpa. We spent six full days and maybe the major part of those six nights till early morning deliberating on the final text. So we covered a vast terrain of subjects, but not all of them find itself into the declaration, because ultimately BRICS, the language that we put in the declaration that adopted, is by consensus.
So the human rights became a casualty.
It's not a casual. You see, one of the things we have been saying, and I want to maybe touch on the civil society interaction. When we were engaging with our civil society structures, there was a lot of agreement between ourselves and the civil society organizations that we need this. South Africa was the one pushing that you must have a civil society track, or you're going to have what happened to the G7, G8. Wherever you have a summit, you have mass demonstrations, and the public totally opposed to the leadership in terms of what they are discussing. We said we don't want that situation. BRICS must be about our people. But what we advise our civil society, those countries that are a bit sensitive, and I wouldn't use the word opposed, not comfortable to have a civil society check, let's take them along gradually. Let's not antagonize them and impose something on them, then they close doors. And that approach has worked. The fact that we hosted a civil society check in Russia, it may not be perfect. It's our first cut. But the mere fact that you've got Russia, you've got China, to now be part of a civil society check, that is progress. It's an incremental progress. But we'll keep pushing that door further and further open until this trust deficit that has been spoken about, which is there. Because we haven't been taking BRICS now into our seventh year. And it's only now we bring civil society on board. So obviously there's going to be a bit of mistrust in terms of intention. But we'll have to make them feel assured that they are an integral part, like the academics, like the business council, who feel totally comfortable now within the BRICS society. Likewise, we have to nurture the civil society participation and continue to interact with them in a dynamic form. And I believe that will come. That will come. We have made a good beginning. With regard to the trade unions, as I said, this was something that South Africa, COSATU initiated. The first meeting in South Africa was convened by COSATU. And this itself, there was reluctance because, remember, not all BRICS countries have dynamic, organized labor. Not all. So, what is the value that South Africa brings to the BRICS? Our culture of human rights, we keep bringing that on the table. Our culture of an open, transparent society with participation of all levels and strata of society in a dynamic, interactive way with government, we put that on the table. So the fact that you have trade unions meeting, it's a very important development, but like we have said, step by step, so we don't along the way and try to kill off an initiative that holds out a lot of promise. So we believe that this will continue to strengthen and continue to enrich the intergovernmental process. Now, with regard to the new Russia nuclear deal, no, this was not discussed because the BRICS was not a bilateral meeting. It was a meeting of the BRICS family. Yes, there were bilaterals on the margins, but these were short bilaterals, more courtesy. But what was discussed within BRICS and agreed that we need an energy check. So we have now agreed that there will be a meeting of ministers of energy of the BRICS countries. And that meeting is still to come.
Can I just add to what Dr. Sukral has raised? Mr. Mokhalapa, through your chairperson, raised the question of whether BRICS remained more of a trade bloc than a political structure. It's an important question. I think the reason why it shied away from declaring itself on the reform or transformation of the UN Security Council because three of the five countries within BRICS aspire to be appointed as permanent members of the Security Council. Brazil, India, and South Africa all have made their ambitions very clear. They wish to be appointed to that one. So there you have the BRICS family. And three of the family members want to serve on this body. Now, how does the family then declare itself? Does it declare itself in favor of the one or all three? And it found itself in this awkward situation and chose rather than to remain silent on the matter. But please don't misunderstand that silence as being not interested in transformation of the UN Security Council. Far from it.
Maybe, Chair, can this also add a very tangible example of BRICS intervening on the global political stage? You recall on the eve of the G20 summit in St. Petersburg in 2013. President Obama had taken a decision to bomb Syria. That decision was a fait accompli. Now G20, as you know, the G20 agenda is focus on the finance and economic. G20 has never discussed political issues. But at that summit, President Putin opened up a debate on Syria and what's going to happen in Syria. For the first time in the G20 summit, you had a discussion on Syria and the political crisis there. The BRICS countries stood firm that there should be no unilateral bombing or forced removal of elected leaders. That whatever has to happen in Syria must go through a UN process. Because of that BRICS voice speaking as one, the other majority G20 members all supported that. So what you had at the G20 summit, the majority in G20 said that we must go the UN route. So the US and some of the partners found themselves isolated. And they didn't bomb Syria. And that was the correct decision. Imagine if you had such a situation, what would have happened today? Given Syria is burning at the moment, how much more dramatic it is. I'm just giving you one tangible example of BRICS political intervention and working together for the good of the global community. On the issue of the anti-BRICS sentiment, unfortunately this will continue. This will continue because BRICS is challenging the established global order. Those that sit around the high table don't want to make space for new players. And you're going to have this contestation as an ongoing thing. What we need to do is to ramp up our public diplomacy efforts. And the BRICS countries are mindful of this. That is why they've asked for the first meeting of the media persons of BRICS countries to come together to see how jointly we can craft a strategy in terms of addressing this, not only within our specific region, but on the global stage. So that's in response to that. With regard to China, the flights to China, the direct flight was cut by us. FAA had direct flights.
Yeah.
And as you know, they have explained it was running at a loss of something like 30 million a month, according to them. Now, Air China is going to have direct flights from October to from Beijing to Johannesburg. That has been agreed on. We just came from a state visit in December, President Zuma, where we signed a 5 to 10 year program, strategic program of cooperation with China. It's a very comprehensive document on how South Africa and China is going to work together for the next 5 to 10 years in addressing 5 priority areas. One, to assist South Africa in its industrialization process, and what China is going to do in tangibly assisting us. Relocating plants to South Africa. You know, the cost of labor today in China is $650 per month. The cost of labor in Vietnam is $193 per month. In South Africa, I think it's around $350 a month. I'm talking about basic salary. So the cost of manufacturing in South Africa is almost half that of China. So it makes sense for China, because China is moving upstream. They no longer want to be known as the manufacturing floor of the world. You hardly see hangers on the side of the streets anymore. You know, before every robo you go, they should be selling plastic hangers. Now you hardly see that. Because China is moving up. China wants to upscale its economic development to upstream manufacturing. So if you go to China today, there's a silk market, for those of you who have been to Beijing, where you can buy clothes, very cheap, name brand clothes. They tell you it's fake, right? But it's no more cheap. The rand to the yuan is 2 to 1 now. 2 rands make a yuan. So China is relocating, and Africa is one of the destinations where they're looking at relocation. And therefore, we are saying come and manufacture here and beneficiate our project. When we were there, China announced a new investment of $13 billion, Hebei steel plant that's going to be established in South Africa. The province is known to us. But it's not just a steel plant. It is also downstream manufacturing. Just one example of China is going to help us, that's in the industrialization, in the SEZs, our SEZs that we've launched. Remember, China, part of the success story is based on the special economic zones. And that's why Deputy President was there last month as a follow-up. And Deputy President took 15 representatives from our SOEs. His focus was just on 3 areas. What can we learn from China in reforming our SOEs, because China is busy reforming their SOEs. The SOE is a turnaround now and it's a profit-making entity. What can we learn? Secondly, in terms of skills, the major focus was on skills, and the third focus one was on concessionary finance. Remember, China, with all of its economic problems, including the recent stock market debacle that took place, China had a foreign reserve of $4 trillion. $4 trillion foreign reserve. They're not going to be in trouble. They don't need the CRA. China don't need it. They'll never dip into it. But not only that, the largest holder of U.S. debt, $1.3 trillion. If China calls in that debt, U.S. will be in serious trouble. So China may be slowing down. That's natural. Over three decades of double-digit growth, naturally you're going to find a cooling down of the economy. But 7% is still impressive, even if it's 5 or 6% as it is the scale of economy. So the China-South African relationship is very solid, and as I said, we've got a solid program in place. Term of office holders is 6 years, rotational,
yes,
in terms of
DBG.
In terms of the Brexit.
We have 1 hour left now.
UN reform, we say this every time. If you look at every speech of President Zuma at the General Assembly, he'll say it again now in September, in very strong language. We want total reform of the UN, including its Security Council, to ensure Africa is reformed, UN Security Council. NDP, World Bank, totally different. You know, the first reaction to World Bank, when in 2013 we announced creating a bank, they were very critical. Now they say they welcome it. But we have said that this bank is not in competition with anyone, like BRICS is not in competition with anyone. But it complements, it's another avenue for countries that have problems accessing finance for their own development. It's another avenue. First for BRICS countries, and it will be open to other developing countries. We've said at least 60% of the shareholding will be held by BRICS so that you don't lose control of this bank. But there's 40% there, and many countries have already shown interest that they want to buy shares into this bank. And once the bank is up and running, the constitution and articles of association make provision for that, that others can, a number of Middle Eastern countries have already knocked on the door, said we want to come into this, like the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank that was spoken about. This was China's vision in terms of addressing its regional infrastructure, and that's the difference between the NDP. NDP is about BRICS and the developing world. Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank, the word Asia, is for the region to address infrastructure. Our needs in Africa is about $100 billion annually in terms of our infrastructure needs in Africa. Asia's needs up to 2050 is $750 billion annually. That's where the funding gap is. And so this is an additional mechanism for them, but we are founding members. Only two African countries were invited to be founding members, South Africa and Egypt. And we are a founding member. We still to sign because it must come to Parliament for ratification. I know we are hard pressed for time. I'm just trying to select some of the more...
Don't lose the meat. Want all the meat.
In terms of how the vice president, presidents and so forth were chosen, the president, as I said, was fanned out to India, so India chose the president. We were given the post of vice president and each country non-executive director. National Treasury led that process. They identified candidates and took it to cabinet, and cabinet endorsed. That's how those appointments came about. But I must point out, maybe I can jump to Honorable Olumisa's question, that we investing, each country has to put $2 billion over the next 7 years because it's equal shareholding. The question raised is, how is this going to benefit South Africa? Now, the president of the bank, remember they've taken office. 21st July they opened doors. They've taken office, they're sitting in Shanghai already, including Leslie Malmstrom. He's finding a house already there. He's going to be based there for the next 6 years. We have been asked to come up with project proposals. And we have been given a deadline. This new president is pushing. He says, come early next year. By March next year, this bank will disperse its first loan. And remember, we said this bank is for infrastructure and sustainable development. So as you know, know, we have an inter-ministerial committee on BRICS comprising 8 departments chaired by our minister. Yesterday in the morning, minister convened that meeting. And we have given departments a deadline of end of August to come up with viable projects, not projects that are not ready to be implemented. Because we want to go to the bank to say, we have this housing project, if I can use this, that as an arbitrary example, ready to roll, we need so many billion loans from the bank. So that's what we've asked all national departments by end of August to give us project proposals. That will be then taken through to the senior officials of BRICS, the committee chaired by DG Majila and all the other DGs, sifted through and a recommendation sent to the ministers so that we are amongst the first in line. What we said, we should have at least 3 to 5 projects on the table. And at least the majority should be domestic, national projects, but 1 or 2 should be continental. Because we've said this bank is also about our continent and how we advance the needs of the continent. So that's where we are in that process. I'm sure before the end of the year, Honorable Alumisa, we can come back to you and say we have forwarded these 5 projects to the NDB as our first phase projects to roll out. And this will be the most tangible example of how BRICS is working for us and changing the life of ordinary South Africans. The strategy of the BRICS Economic Partnership, as I said, is a very good strategy. It does address the issue of beneficiation. It does address the issue of industrialization. It does address the issue of skills. Now, skills transfer is already happening. Every ministerial committee, for example, the health sector, India is very strong in the pharmaceutical sector, as we all know, as an example. So, Brazil is very strong in the agriculture sector and the energy sector. So what has been agreed in these ministerial tracks that there will also be skills transfer and technology transfer. So if you look at each of the ministerial tracks, what is happening, it addresses these issues as well. It's happening at that level. I think, honorable member, there's a clear distinction between the NDB contributions and the CRA. The CRA formula that is mentioned there, that's to the CRA. NDB is equal shareholding, equal capital. All of us are putting 10 billion each. That's how you get the 50 billion. That's why it's equal shareholding, equal say in terms of the running of the bank. The CRA is based on size of GDP. That is why China is putting 41 billion, India, Brazil, 18 billion, and we're putting the 5 billion. But the formula is in terms of drawing rights. But if you look at the formula for South Africa, we'll still be able to draw substantially in terms of that 5 billion that we may have to put in. So that formula is for the CRA, and it doesn't disadvantage us. It's a safety net. It's a safety net and guarantees us capital should South Africa fall into serious fiscal crisis. Yes, something that we can draw against based on our contribution, but it's still substantial. In fact, if I'm not a mathematician, but I'm told by our colleagues from National Treasury, based on our contribution and our drawing rights, we are the most advantaged in this process. Yes, BRICS is about competition and cooperation. That is normal. But what we have found in BRICS, you know, many people say there's so much of divergence among BRICS. How is it that these countries can work together? But we have showed that there is so much that is gelling us together that is far greater than our differences. You'll always find differences. You'll never find. Within the European Union, look at what is happening in Greece and the European Union, the crisis there. They are not speaking in one voice. G7 never speaks in one voice on all of the issues. So naturally, there will be issues we will disagree on. But what I keep saying is that if you look at the level of cooperation that binds us together, that far outweighs our differences. I think, Chair, I will stop there. I'm not sure. I may have misunderstood.
Yeah, not close it at that. According to my watch, it's 25 to 12.
Yeah.
We've got to be done by 25 at least. The next item you're going to present on is on Number five. Yes.
How much do you? How much do you just a minute?
Chairperson, let me first of all begin by addressing you and committee members, honorable committee members. The state has applied for leave, made application for leave to appeal the High Court's decision on the Omar al-Bashir. That being the case, it therefore puts this matter within, firmly within sub judice rules. And my legal advice that I have received on this matter is not to address this matter, lest we fall foul of the provisions of the sub judice. That being the case, then, Chairperson, we will not be going into the matter of Omar al-Bashir. What we can do is provide you with a briefing on the outcomes of the AU summit that was held in June this year. With your permission.
In other words, you want to concentrate on the outcome of the AU summit in Sentin, barring the present other judgment of him, because of what you said. Honorable Kalyan?
Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson. With regard to the sub judice rule, I do not accept that the matter cannot be discussed in committee, because according to the rules of Parliament, the sub judice rule only applies if the material outcome of the case will be affected in any way. And that is, I know that because I'm sitting on the review of rules, and I have been sitting on that since the last Parliament, and we're just about completing our work. So I'm saying that the defense of the sub judice rule does not apply, because by the Deputy Minister briefing the committee, he is not in any way affecting the material outcome of the case.
Follow up by Honorable Mohalapa.
Thank you very much, Chair. I concur with my colleague. And firstly, I would want to have appreciated in de facto the fact that we put this on the agenda. If you recall, at the height of this happening and this saga, I requested a portfolio briefing on the matter, and the committee acceded to the fact that in execution of our oversight role and holding the executive accountable, we should have a briefing. So this, what is happening now, should have happened almost a month ago. At this point in time, this matter is hot under the bridge. But we could have appreciated the Deputy Minister's briefing on this. And I concur, it has no substantiated. We have debated it in Parliament. So I don't think that the judicial rule is applicable in this instance, because all we need is for the Deputy Minister to take us into his confidence and say, this is what happened, this was the rationale of the decisions that were taken, and then we leave it at that. It's not that this committee is going to take the executive to court. The matter is in court, it's a separate issue and matter, but with us executing our oversight and our mandate as a portfolio committee of Parliament, we should give the minister an opportunity to address us in this matter, because of it's an important matter of public importance, and us as legislators at the forefront of public discourse, we should be able to know the rationale behind government. So let us separate the issue that is in court and deal with the matter that is before us, which is a briefing by the department. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Olomisa.
Chairperson, let me advise the Deputy Minister, in the spirit of non-interference, Why don't you just repeat what the president told us and the country in parliament last week? Exactly, verbatim. Why you did not act against this person? Because he was here as a guest of the AU and not as a state. You are not invited by the country, by South Africa. Just repeat it as it is, for record. And don't waste your time.
Are you done, or all of me, sir? RRTM?
No, I hear what the Honorable Holomisa says, and then you don't need me to give you a briefing. You've been briefed by the President. But of course, you and I know that following what the President says, you have additional questions. I've been in this place for 20 years, and those additional questions may lead us into very dangerous waters that will impact on the subjudicator.
Are you a Sangoma?
No, I'm not a Sangoma. I'm not a Sangoma, but I've been a member of Parliament since 1994, and I know how all of us think, both you as opposition members and me as a member of the ANC. We think the same way. So, Chairperson, I hear what the honourable members are saying, and I hear in particular what the Honourable Kalyan is saying about the material outcome of the case. The truth of the matter is you're going to impinge on the sub judice rule, however you may try and explain it away. Now, if we want to stand by what the Honourable Holomisa is saying, namely that the President has explained it, fine, then please take the President's explanation and accept that as a briefing. But you're not going to do that. You want me to expand and go into other aspects of the matter. And the minute I do that, there you have a problem. I agree with the Honourable Mukhalafa that the matter is of public importance. But we've had other matters of public importance that have been before the courts, and we've been unable to discuss them, both in committee and in the House.
The fact that we debated this matter, sorry, Chair.
Debated it where?
In the House.
Well,
we had a debate.
That
about
was
this
before
matter.
That was before the application for leave to appeal. That was before the application for leave to appeal. Once the application for leave to appeal was submitted, it became sub judice.
Okay.
I think there is difference in interpretation, but we'll go by your ruling, Chair, but I think that Jim being a Sangoma would not agree with you.
No. You know, honourable members, I want to say that if the department says it really wants to stick to the respect for the sub judice rule that applies in this specific instance of President al-Bashir, let's allow that. For the case to be heard, or for the response to be given to court, and everything to run its course, with the understanding that you owe, wait a minute, that you owe the committee a very comprehensive explanation, and after that, of course, a discussion, because indeed the Honourable Mukhalafa did ask that the matter should serve as an item, and I said no, but the matter is not to be care. And now it's almost a month later, the matter is still not to be care. But it's a matter that must come for discussion, because if any other time when a matter like this arises, members should know what should happen. And I hope I'm not muddying the water. The thing is, President al-Bashir may also visit other countries that are signatories
to their home status. You know, all of those things will take that into account so that when it applies to any other state or any other person, at least we'll know what happens regarding matters like this. But can we close it at that? And I know it's not comfortable, but let's close it at that. Now, the outcomes of the summit itself, because they are outside the president.
Chair, we will accede to your ruling on that. Like I said, we would not agree with you on that one, but be it as it may. Isn't it appropriate to get a parliamentary law advice in terms of the subsidy care rule pertaining to this matter? When does it become? Because if it's a matter of interpretation, wouldn't it be appropriate? I take the concession that we are making that after the court case, the department should come back to us, but in terms of the sub judice rule, isn't it advisable to get a parliamentary law advice and be given to the committee in writing on that one?
In other words, that will be given a legal opinion?
Yes.
By parliament?
Yes. In terms of ourselves conducting oversight over the department. And the fact that the department is saying to us it's a sub judice matter, what does the rules of parliament say about that? And then it will satisfy our souls.
Okay.
Thank you, Sir President. First of all, I'll just say even up front that I agree with your observation and your direction you have given to the committee. And then there's no harm, Minister. There's no harm in getting the legal advice. There's absolutely no harm in getting the legal advice. We can get it, but at the end of the day, it is us who's going to decide whether we accept it or not, as the portfolio committee. I think that's what must be clear around that. Sure.
Okay, we will seek that legal opinion from Parliament around this matter.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, thank you. Matter is closed at that, at least for today. Over to you, DM, on the AU.
Yes, I'm going to ask Ms. Sandy Stock to read the presentation in the same way that Dr. Sikla did. Hand over to you.
Honourable Chair, Honourable Deputy Minister, and Honourable Members of the Committee.
The Chairperson, may I address you?
Chair, there is an address to you.
Yes.
May I address you on a point of order?
Yes.
The item that's about to be discussed now, the AU outcome, is not on the agenda.
It is.
Well, not on the agenda that I have.
Let me read it for you. Briefing by the Department on the participation of President Al-Bashir in the African Union Summit held in South Africa on the 7th to 15th June 2015. Remember, there are two matters in this matter. You have the issue of President Al-Bashir, but you also have the summit itself that was held. Maybe the way it was crafted, it just, it clouded. It clouded what should also have been the outcomes of the AU Sentencing Summit.
But that should have been written here.
Yeah, I think it could have been written better.
It doesn't say anything here about the outcome.
Yeah, it could have been written better. Mm-hmm. I agree with you. But that's what we still intended, that the outcomes be presented to us. Thank you very much. Over to you, Sukla. No.
Well, Chair, shouldn't you ask us whether we are happy to entertain this new item? Because it's not here. Maybe we can decide that we want to have it now. It's really appropriate if you also admit that it's not here. And I think the formality just to say, do we take it now? Because I don't think anybody would oppose taking it now. But the appropriate thing to do is to say, seeing as it is not here, can we accept it to add it to this agenda and take it immediately? It saves all of us time.
Can I hear you?
Well, we are reluctant to entertain the briefing as long as it doesn't include Al-Bashir.
No, but it's two separate things. Okay.
Then it should have been two separate items. There should have been number 5 and number 6. So this issue of Al-Bashir would have been a separate matter to the outcomes of the summit, because it did happen even though he disappeared mysteriously. The summit itself continues. So we would have entertained that as a separate issue to his disappearance. So the issue before the court now is the mysterious disappearance, but this outcomes is not before the, it can be subjugated, that issue, because it's not before the court.
Thank you very much, Honorable Khadere.
Oh, thank you, Chairperson. I totally disagree with my colleague, Honorable Khalaba, that we must not take this issue here. Because I think what is happening here, when you look at that thing, at the agenda item itself, it's dedicated African Union Summit Health. Yeah. When I'm speaking about the summit, definitely, what happened? You are going to deal with it in its entirety. In its entirety, that's the summit. Part of the summit that there are certain results which came out of that. That whether Al-Bashir participated or not is another matter, but the issue of the summit it is yet. And then I think that as other people who are always professing that we are wary of fruitless expenditure, I don't think that when we are having the CPC already here, that we can turn him back to Pretoria without 7 days. No harm in that. So I don't concur with my colleague. I think that we can take the presentation. Thank you.
No, Chair.
However, Khadir, I said to Kalien that the sentence itself, Khadir, I'm responding to you, that the sentence is badly crafted. In my mind, when I look at the item, I didn't think that it will be the matter about Al-Bashir and the matter about the summit. Because you look at the date, it's 7 up to 15, and of course there are decisions that were taken there. But now that he has picked that up, I admitted that it was badly formulated to show the weakness that she was pointing out. Then, Honorable Lekota then said, I must then ask the House whether we then agree with her presentation. And of course, Mukhalapa says, no, you are saying no, let's proceed because we have invited the department, it will be fruitless expenditure. And then the main thing is, what are the outcomes? Just like the UFA. Can I hear other members? Honorable Kenya?
Thank you, Chairperson. As Lucas Madam said, we must just rephrase, must not take the presentation, but to rephrase the sentence to say, briefing by the department on the participation of President Al-Bashir in the African Union Summit, and the briefing on the summit on the 7th to 15th June.
Unless there is an end here, unless there's an end here. Honorable Khadija is complicating a thing that is very straightforward.
Yeah.
Two things will be one and another. And there's no end here.
It's English semantics.
So please, man, let's take the report. Let's take.
Order.
Can we agree that?
Chairperson, I'm on a point of order. No, I'm on a point of order. Comrade Mkhalapa, Honorable Mkhalapa cannot attack me and then allow it.
Honorable Kenya was on the floor.
Outcomes of the summit, the African Union summit, which took place at the Sandton Convention Center, as well as within the Department of International Relations and Cooperation, where the Permanent Representative Council had its own sessions preparing for the summit. It met on the 7th and 8th of June, whilst at the same time, later on, the Executive Council convened from the 11th and the 12th of June. Following that was the actual summit on the 14th and 15th of June. Chairperson, the South Africa at the time was led at the summit by the President, the Minister of International Relations, Minister of State Security, Defense, Women, Trade and Home Affairs. The theme of the summit, Chair, was Women's Empowerment and Development towards Agenda 2063. As the committee would remember, and the honourable members would remember, we did a presentation on Agenda 2063 earlier on to the committee, as well as to the joint sitting of Parliament on the 31st of October last year. The summit took place, Chairperson, and it started with a closed session, where South Africa was requested by the AU Commission to make a presentation on xenophobia as well as migration. The issue was debated at length, and what it did, Chairperson, was to actually highlight the critical role played by the countries of origin when it talks to migration. Countries of transit as well as the countries of destination. As such, that discussion, Chairperson, led into the adoption of a declaration on migration with a specific instruction given to the Executive Council to have a retreat and to discuss the issue of mobility and free movement of people in Africa, as well as to develop a common position for Africa before the Malta Conference on Migration of the European Union in November 2015. The declaration also urged the Executive Council to also discuss, look at the development of a protocol on free movement of persons, as well as in collaboration with member states to also engage in the process of developing capacity to manage migration flows within the continent. Coming back, Chairperson, to the summit, as I indicated, the theme of the summit is on women development and women empowerment and development towards Agenda 2063, which of course Agenda 2063 is a 50-year framework that sets Africa on the path to achieving integration, prosperity, and peace. The summit also adopted a 10-year implementation plan. The theme of the summit cut across all the discussions and it permeated through all the discussions within the processes of the organs of the AU, as well as in and around the activity, in and around the summit. In other words, different organizations, civil society organizations, had a thorough discussion on the theme of the summit. The chairperson of the union during the summit also announced that a gender scorecard would be launched as an instrument to monitor progress in women's development, to share best practices, and to be able to hold each other accountable. At the same time, the head of state launched a campaign to confine the handheld pool to museum in an accelerated effort to assist women with access to modern technology, land, credit, and extension services in order to empower women in agriculture and agro-industry. The summit also adopted the declaration on 2015 year of women's empowerment and development towards Agenda 2063 with a firm commitment on enhancing women's contribution and benefits from formal agriculture, agribusiness value chains, enhancing women's access to health, pushing forward women's economic empowerment, enhancing the agenda on women, peace and security, enhancing women's participation in governance, enhancing women and girls' access to education, science, and technology with mutual accountability to action and results. It also agreed on strengthening the AU Commission support to deliver on the very same commitments as alluded to in the declaration. The declaration, Chairperson, also ends with a commitment to an expedient process of translating economic and transformational commitments into results. As such, the Assembly committed itself to mainstreaming women as the continent begins to implement Agenda 2063. During the summit, the Chairperson, a presentation and the report was made on the launch of the Continental Free Trade Area negotiations. The summit adopted a declaration on this specific Continental Free Trade Area negotiations. It also had a decision on the Ebola virus disease and noted that the outbreak emergency is over and that the African Union support to Ebola outbreak in West Africa mission is preparing for the final exit, and of course with members of the South African team who participated there returning now during the course of the week. The summit also received the report of the AIDS Watch Africa, and the Assembly then decided to extend the AU roadmap on shared responsibility and global solidarity for AIDS, TB and malaria response in Africa from 2016 to 2020 with the purpose of achieving full implementation and reaffirming its commitment to strengthen health system and to increase domestic funding in line with the Abuja 15% target. The summit also adopted the naming of the African Union Garden under the name of Professor Wangari Maathai in recognition of the environmental conservation and protection in appreciation by African Union for her contribution towards the issues related to the environment. The summit also adopted the outcomes of the Dakar Summit on Higher Education and requested the Commission to take the lead in building the African Common Space for Higher Education and Research. It also requested member states to, among others, strengthen their support and investment in higher education in order to develop a critical mass of high-level intellectual capital and promote youth and youth employability through entrepreneurship, skills, and innovation. On the state of progress and accelerated implementation of the decision on the establishment of the South-South Triangular Coalition in support of Africa for 2015, the Assembly requested the Commission to organize, in collaboration with partners, a conference of partners of the coalition before the end of December 2015. The summit also adopted a report of the Committee of 10 Heads of State and Government on the reform of the United Nations Security Council. In its discussion, Chairperson, the summit reaffirmed its earlier decision on UN reform, with specific reference to the need to address the historical injustice that Africa has been suffering from since the establishment of the UN, with non-representativity at the United Nations Security Council. So there's that commitment, reaffirmation of the commitment to implement the Ezulwini consensus. The declaration thereof is also available, Chairperson. The Zulwini consensus. The summit, the Executive Council Chairperson held a meeting at Zulwini in Swaziland, during which the discussion around the United Nations reform was discussed and an African position was formulated, hence the Zulwini consensus. So the summit in June reiterated its initial position to call on the UN for reform and to ensure that Africa is represented at both the permanent member of the permanent five, as well as the United Nations in general. There is also Chairperson. I'm not going to go through it. My apologies. I'm not going to go through all the decisions. We're only picking up on the specific decisions. Chair, there's also a declaration on self-reliance that was adopted in the summit. The declaration, Chairperson, stems from the fact that for quite some time the AUC has had difficulties implementing its programs due to the fact that the member states were paying less compared to the contributions coming from partners. The declaration on self-reliance is basically aimed at ensuring that domestic resources are organized so that the AU is better prepared and able to implement its own programs. The key example of this experience, Chair, was during the eruption of challenges in Libya, when the AUC had taken a decision that the then Commissioner for Peace and Security should travel to Libya. As he was preparing to travel to Libya to establish an AU liaison office, he received a call from Brussels, from the EU, clearly indicating that they would not accept their money to be used by the AUC to go and address issues in Libya, either at that time. So such experiences have kind of necessitated and galvanized the AU leadership and the AU member states to come up with a declaration on self-reliance. It was then adopted, and it also approved the first 10-year implementation plan, as well as its financing mechanism, as a step forward towards Africa's collective vision for the level and depth of integration and development that the continent must achieve in the next 50 years. Chair, there are a number of the decisions. We have all the decisions at our disposal. We will be able to make them available to the members of the committee to look at them, because there are quite a number of the decisions. But the key decisions that South Africa had an interest in and would like the Johannesburg Summit to be remembered for is the decision on self-reliance, the decision on the working methods of the African Union, the decision on Agenda 2063, 10-year implementation plan, as well as the declaration on women empowerment and development towards Agenda 2063. Maybe I should stop there. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. And we must also thank you, DM, for simplifying, with this note. I have looked at the resource decisions. It's just mired in a lot of maze. It's hazy and murky, as they say.
Yeah.
Mm. we would not be able to lift out the salient point. Honourable members, refer to a specific page and to a specific point. I think there are about 24 points, right? Well, the pages are not numbered, unfortunately. But at least the paragraphs are numbered. If there are any comments and clarification questions. Honorable Bergman.
Thank you. Chair, just on
the 2.14.
I was just interested to find out who formed part of that triangular coalition, if it was people outside of the, if it was countries outside of the African Union itself. And then with regards to the hot potato, the Middle East, on 2.21, where the African Union and GOCO might not be under the same, you know, there might be discrepancies in their own resolutions, their internal domestic resolutions, and the African Union. Do we assume that the African Union's resolutions take precedence? Do we adapt to ours, or do you know what has been the historic precedent in this regard of the African Union and South Africa's own legislation?
Thank you. Honourable Kalyan.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, with regard to 2.21, I would like to know what would South Africa's position be on that resolution. Also, what is the status of this document? Will it come before Parliament for tabling and discussion and debate on it? Although this was an AU summit, was anyone from the portfolio committee, this portfolio committee, invited to attend as an observer? Because I would imagine that, seeing that it was held in our country, although hosted by the AU, that perhaps somebody from this committee would be invited. Just for two.
Thank you very much. Honorable Mayela.
Chairperson. Chairperson, the summit endorsed the Zuluni consensus. I just simply wanted to check what the Zuluni consensus takes on the issue of the right of veto. The right of veto in the United Nations. And the issue of polio eradication, that's 2.19. I just wanted to check, because where I am, I thought this issue of polio was long forgotten. I just wanted to check what is the status of the threat of polio in Africa. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Any takers? Honorable Kenya.
Thank you, Sebastian. My question has been asked, my two questions. But now just to check, I'm worried that yes, I understand that there was a lot that was that came out first, and also I commend the team that talks to women of the sun. But what is worrying me is that this talk a little about women, as Honorable Mayela has indicated in the last in the previous presentation. Now, also I've been talking about the NDPs, which I am worried because nobody seems to take notice of what I say. Now, because you understand now, when I look at this, that they are talking about all the about this goal, 6, specifically the HIV AIDS and also the malaria. So that goes back to my question which was just answered about the MDGs. Because if the health issues are not here, because you notice that the health issues are not taken seriously there in that
in that first presentation, but in the BRICS front. But you can see the EU has taken seriously the HIV/AIDS, as that they have got also a report on AIDS Watch Africa, which makes sense. If I don't know whether as a country also we can really be able to get this evaluation so that when there's that summit in September, it's so something I'm worried because it's not clear in that sort. So I worry that summit in September, something must come out noting that this report is clear on the issue of HIV AIDS, which also is a deadly disease, really, especially when you look at HIV that talks, when you look at AIDS, also with Ebola. Now that yes, I understand Ebola now, outbreak. Maybe if
okay,
also.
Sorry, Malaga, Kat.
Oh, you're sorry.
And I have to leave for college.
Yeah. Okay, let me first.
Peperella.
Yeah, Peperella, okay. But I just want to protect me from honorable colleagues. No. She talks a lot also. Too much, so no good voice complaining. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. We really welcome this report, which is coming from the department. But I only have 3 questions to raise. On the issue of the xenophobic report, which was presented by South Africa, how was it received? Can we get any indicators around that? Number two, on the continental free trade area, because what you are going to involve the movement of the people is still from one country. But the lash on the issue of the instability in the north of Africa, how will it impact on this, the creation of the continental free trade area? And then the last one, the issue of self-reliance. We know very well that other countries, they depend on donor funding even to finance their budget. How will they contribute? Will it be the issue of an equal formula? What is it? I know that right now, the issue of the bigger economies, they contribute no more. But what is it? How is it? What is the final model if they come with? Because it was temporal, that one, of over 100 days.
Yeah, thank you very much, Khatale. From me is the... I noted you.
Thanks very much, Chef. I think Honorable Hadebe covered me specially, but I just want to re-emphasize it. It's on the issue of self-reliance. Did the conference adopt the Obasanjo report? Then if so, what will be the amendment or, if any, time frame given to that report? Then the issue of, because of the only effect to self-reliability in terms of the African capacity on immediate response, but they did not refer to ARPM, which was one of the reasons why there was issue of self-reliance, the African peer review mechanism. That secretariat cannot function because of funding issues. Thanks very much.
Yeah, from me, the 10-year implementation plan, is it taking immediate effect from the Johannesburg, the sentence summit, which is 2015, meaning how is it infused into, for instance, in our case, the 5-year strategic plan, which is up to 2019, or the vision 2030, or if elections were held in Zimbabwe last year, or they will be held in Botswana next year. But I'm happy at the same time about the 10-year implementation, at least every 10 years, you see. How far is the Agenda 2063 being implemented for assessment? You have very little time to respond.
Thank you, Chair. The 10-year implementation plan, Chair, if we started it, the assembly mandated the commission to actually start working on the modality of the implementation of the 10-year of the plan itself. So at the moment, the summit will also discuss that, because the implementation would start next year going forward, by 2023, that will be the evaluation of the first 10-year implementation plan. However, the AUC did make presentation on key specific projects that are aimed at connecting the continent. The Inga project, for example, Chairperson, the Inga Hydro project, as well as the implementation of the Yamasuko declaration that talks to aviation in the continent. But the Commission is currently working on the modalities on the implementation of the 10-year plan. Chair, the question on the question of the on self-reliance on Obasanjo report. The Obasanjo report culminated into a decision on alternative sources of funding the African Union. And the decision itself makes it clear that it's not going to be a one-size-fits-all. Countries themselves would look at finding alternative with alternative sources of making contributions towards the AU. At the moment, the key contribution that was made by countries was through the annual asset contribution. So the AU and the decision of the summit was that member states should then look at other modalities to see besides only the asset contribution based on the scale of assessment. So the countries are then left to really make their own determination on how to go about getting finding alternative sources towards the aim.
You mean the GDP size and the population
yes.
size?
Yes.
How do you answer this? Just getting clarity.
Just clarity.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, honorable. On the UN reform, Chair, the decision of the summit was that the UN the summit was quite unequivocal in ensuring that the position of the AU based in Eswatini and in Sirte, consisting of the claim of two additional seats, one in the category of the non-permanent members and two seats in the category of permanent members with same rights, privileges, obligations accorded to the current member states, including the right to veto. That's the position. Chair, on the Palestinian position, there is a declaration on the situation in Palestine and in the Middle East that South Africa also supported. The declaration articulates key areas around the challenges facing that, because it's a declaration stemming from the report on the situation in the Middle East and Palestine. And the declaration also recalls all resolutions and decisions adopted by the OAU AU on the situation in Palestine and the Middle East. That's the decision of this. That's the declaration four in the decisions of the summit.
What
does
it say?
And that
is
Minister, we have 6 minutes now.
Yes,
there's still an item to handle.
Yeah. Well, Chair, there was a question from the Honourable Kalyan about whether the portfolio committee
was invited
and or members was invited. Now, to my knowledge,
no.
It was not.
No.
No.
We are not head of state.
No. Well, the answer to the question is no.
No.
Now, Chair, if the portfolio committee feels that the next time the summit is held in South Africa and it should be invited, then I think it's for the portfolio committee to take the necessary steps to try and ensure that that happens. Whether you succeed is another matter. I see Honourable Nkosi shaking his head. Honourable Kalyan didn't ask it because she was just in a particular mood. She asked it for a reason.
Mm.
So So that's as far as that is concerned. The Honourable Bergman asked the question about AU resolutions and South Africa's position thereto. Now, Mr. Skalk has responded as far as paragraph 2.21 is concerned. Generally speaking, what we try to do as a continent and as a collective is to move as one. So that when we go to the UN General Assembly, we adopt a single resolution that the entire continent supports. That's what we try to do in general. So I think, Chairperson, you're all familiar with this, and that applies to other regional bodies as well. So the matter first goes to the regional body. We try to get agreement in the regional body. In our case, it would be SADC. And then from there, we take it to the AU. I'm not sure, Chairperson, whether... how was the report on the attack on foreign nationals in South Africa accepted?
Chairperson, the report... Thank you, Chair. Chairperson, the report that the President presented to his colleagues during the summit was well received. What South Africa has done, the program that the government has rolled out was well received to an extent that even the President of Tanzania was quite firm in ensuring, in indicating that the problem that South Africa faced was not only a South African problem. It was a problem countries of origin have to also take responsibility. Countries of transit have to also take responsibility, because he even gave an example that at some point the security forces in Tanzania arrested more than 40 people who were crammed in one truck. And when they were arrested, people told them that, but why are you arrested?
Skalk, it's sitting at 3 minutes. Let's take heart in the report was well received by the head of state. I'm sorry about that. I'm also sorry for Kenya, who are pressed with that. There is one item remaining. It mainly will come in the form of an announcement. It is the committee program of activities, which is from the 5th of August up to the 26th of September. Now, you'll note that within this program of activities for this term, one of the activities that is supposed to take place is the workshop, the start plan for the committee. Now, the start plan for the committee is now impacted upon by the meeting we're going to attend with Honorable Frolic, because we are going to hear the document before me where he has called those from the NCOP and from the NA, where we will discuss the further guidelines for the set term in 2015. Now, some of the dates that they've already put here may impact on the program, our activity. So what we'll do with the committee secretary is to adjust some of the dates to make sure that the program, the Afro League, flies, and then also our activities will also fly. But we do want to request you to adopt this program of activity, subject to one or two days being shifted to accommodate this one. Can I hear you?
Adopted.
Honorable Kota?
Well, Chair, we can leave our fate in your hands. We adopt it.
With amendment, not fate.
Well, the point is that the change of those days will be decided by him all by himself. So our fate
is with amendment, not fate.
I second
what is being proposed with amendment.
Attention. Okay. Thank you very much. Maila?
No. Whilst I agree, I also agree with the option, but I also want to
bring us back to what was raised by Honorable Kalyan some time ago. That the issues here be in 80 feet.
Oh, yes. Yes. They go to the red list.
Yes.
After the adjustment. Oh, yes. Around the quarter?
No, Chair, please beg your indulgence. You know, I am concerned about this issue that the Honorable Kalyan raised about whether the committee, if it's a meeting of the summit, say the summit of heads of state or something, whether we should do, can we seriously say we should be invited because the
match?
Well, there has to be clarity of state. It's a meeting of heads of state. Now, we are a subcommittee of parliament here. Botswana, Lesotho, Mali, what have got subcommittees of parliament of their own. Now, the thing is once you give a particular status to a country, simply because the meeting is in that country, you're going to provoke all kinds of difficulties. So I really don't want us to leave this question without having clarity about it. Every country is represented. If it's a summit like that, it will be represented by a delegation determined by that country's government and so on. And we can't have access at levels which all the others do not have. And I think myself that we shouldn't live here with differing perceptions that maybe we should, maybe we should not.
Yeah, are you done? I don't know. It's happening than this night on my mind, yeah?
Yeah, let's make time for it.
Can you assist here?
No, Chair, I understand the motivation the Honorable Kalyan is expressing. Aside from the motivation raised by the Honorable Nakwata, we need to also bear in mind, Honorable Kalyan, that the summit doesn't belong to South Africa.
Yes.
It belongs to the AU, and therefore the AU reserves the right to determine who gets invited. And so that's the one major difficulty that you'll be faced with, Chairperson.
Just in concluding, I just say that it's an AU event on South African soil, so I respect the right of the AU for its invitation. But protocol, as always, has been, whether it's the ITU or the CTA or whatever, that in the host country, they normally extend an invitation. And it was just a question as to whether this committee, we are getting a report about the activities of the AU. So, I mean, it would have been nice to have been an observer and actually been there. But it is just an observation. As the Pan-African Parliament, as one of the subsections, you know, of the AU, had an invitation. So I was just, you know, making a comment.
Okay.
Honourable DM and your officials and honourable members, and our officials, the meeting is adjourned, and thank you very much.
No, Honorable Kalyan, there is a young man who,
but aside from his first word, you not mention that
I'm going to go to the
Thank you.